back of the end zone, and it is caught for a touchdown by Holmes.
Welcome back into another edition of the Fifth Down Podcast. I am your host, Mike Fiella. We have a jam-packed show for you all this evening. And first down, I am joined by one of the best baseball writers in the country. He is Bob Nightingale of USA Today to go around the diamond to discuss some of the big news in the baseball world. Some of the issues that Bob and I touched on are the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox, in addition to the two California teams that made so much buzz this offseason, the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. In second down, I am joined by Arizona State men's basketball coach Herb Sendick to get the pulse on the Pac-12 hoops in terms of the offseason, in addition to the NCAA landscape as a whole. We ask Coach Sendick what he thinks the future of college basketball is coming off the national title by Louisville, and we pick his brain about what Jahid Carson, star point guard for the Sun Devils, coming back for his sophomore season means on the court for Arizona State next season. And third down, I give you my take on Derrick Rose, the star point guard for the Chicago Bulls. Rose, obviously, has been out the entire season. He tore his ACL in the playoffs last year. It has been a year since Rose has returned. And there is speculation that Derrick Rose may come back and play this series. So I'll give you my take on that. On fourth down, we discuss how the New York Jets have absolutely mishandled this offseason, especially with quarterback Tim Tebow, Mark Sanchez, and now bringing in Geno Smith. So without further ado, let's hop in to first down. Into first down now, I am joined by one of the leading baseball writers in the country, Bob Nightingale of USA Today. Bob, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mike. Thanks.
Well, Bob, thanks a lot for coming on the show. We figured because it is baseball season, a month in, give or take, we can kind of see how some of the teams are looking thus far. One of the teams we'd like to highlight, the Atlanta Braves, are sitting first in the National League East, and they have a very interesting catcher, Evan Gattis. It's a unique story. Bob, what can you tell us about the catching situation for the Braves?
Well, he was a long shot to make the team, and it's kind of the modern-day version of Josh Hamilton, where he was a highly recruited high school player and dropped out to face Earth for 4 years, going to different jobs, going to drug rehab, things like that. And then, he used to be a ski lift operator, a janitor, you name it, he did it. And now here he is, batting him on the lineup and helping the Braves team to first place in the NL East.
Do you think Gattis will stay with the team when, obviously, Brian McCann, their big-time catcher, comes back from injury? Is he going to go back down, stay with the team? How do you think that'll shake out?
I think he stays with the team. McCann will be the starting guy. And remember, McCann's going to be free agent this year. But the way Gattis is hitting, he's a perfect backup. And I think the guy I have to worry about the job would be Gerald Laird. I think Gattis has won a spot.
Yeah, that would be tough to beat Gerald Laird. It's hard to take someone out like Gattis who's playing so well, and it's such a feel-good story. Another Bray that's had a big year coming over from the Arizona Diamondbacks has been Justin Upton. He's been tearing the cover off the ball. 12 home runs so far this season. He's also brought his brother BJ over in free agency. Is there been a reason why Justin has played so well and BJ has struggled? Or do you think that's just baseball? Sometimes that just happens.
Well, in Justin's case, you see, he was finished fourth in the MVP race just 2 years ago. So the talent hobbies are there. He's only 25. A lot of times when a guy is traded, he wants to prove the team wrong to trade him, like you guys made a big mistake.
Right.
In B.J. Upton's case, you see it time and time again where when a guy signs a big free agent contract and switches teams, he puts so much pressure on himself that he almost kind of kills himself there as far as with expectations and stuff. And it's such a heavy burden for that player. We're seeing the same thing in Anaheim with Josh Hamilton. Same sort of thing.
Hamilton has struggled, and the Angels have been a disappointment thus far, but injuries have played a role. They lost Jared Weaver. They have not gotten the performances from Hamilton. One more on the Braves before we transition over to the AL. What has happened to Dan Uggla? The past couple seasons, it seems like he's just struggled to hit. The power has been there, but not to the same level. Only 19 home runs last season. In 2011, he had 36. What is going on with Dan Uggla? Is he just falling off the cliff, or is there something that can be fixed there?
Yeah, the one thing is to know, it's not like he's an old guy by any means, but he just kind of lost it. And you saw the same thing with McLeod a few years ago, and just on and on. And they, you know, what's going on? It's such a middle game baseball is where you start getting into a slump and just keeps building and building and building. And that is the case with Uglin now. He's just that confidence is shot from what it used to be.
That is interesting. You know, some players like Mark Teixeira, they struggle early, but they seem to be able to turn themselves out of it almost every season. This season, of course, he's hurt. But Uglin has been a very, very big disappointment for the Braves these past two seasons after being, a very big pickup for them early on. For the Angels, as you brought them up, what is going on with the Angels? They've lost Jared Weaver. Their pitching has struggled. Jason Vargas, he's 0-3, a 4.85 ERA, so that's not exactly what they thought they were getting when they picked him up in free agency. What is going on with the Angels?
You know, and even the spring training in Arizona, all the talent evaluators said, what's wrong with this team? They were, the pitching was a mess. You had Jared Weaver and, you know, a bunch of question marks in the rotation. The bullpen was a mess. And, now you're seeing, once Weaver got hurt, breaking the left elbow there, these guys can't go deep in games. So putting so much pressure on the bullpen, and the bullpens are just falling apart.
One of those starters that has been disappointing has been C.J. Wilson this far, an ERA over 4. He is 3-0, however, so he's winning games, but he's not pitching, I'm sure, as well as they would have hoped. Is it a disappointment that C.J. Wilson hasn't stepped up to be the ace in place of Weaver while he's been hurt? Or is this kind of who C.J. Wilson is?
I think they expected better. And maybe it's a reason why the Rangers didn't step out to keep him. He's just been so-so. I mean, he's penciled as a number 2 starter, but really pitching no better than a number 4 starter, maybe even number 5 starter. So, you know, he's not going deep in games, and that's really crushing the bullpen. So, you know, it took him about 120 pitches in a night just to go 6 1/3 innings. So they're expecting more for him. They, you know, you don't give that kind of money just to be a number 4 starter.
To compound the problem, the best player on the Angels might be Mike Trout, the center fielder, who had a fantastic season last year, was the rookie of the year. He had 49 stolen bases, 5 caught stealings. For this year, he's been caught once, and his batting average has dropped significantly, almost 60 points, about 320 to 260. So what is going on with Trout? Is this just a sophomore slump? Was last year too good to be true? Is the truth in between?
I think it's a little bit of a sophomore slump. I think it's more coming back to earth. He was doing some crazy things last year, and it was very unrealistic to think that he could do the same thing, and some people thought he was going to be better. That just wasn't going to happen. So I think you're seeing more than Mike Trout, you know, an excellent ball player, an elite ball player, but not just, you know, the boy saying he's Mickey Mantle and this and that. You know, give some time to see who he is. He also showed up at camp weighing 240 pounds, which kind of alarmed people.
That's true. He did have the suspect beginning to the spring. Another surprising team has been the Boston Red Sox. They have cleared house. They have revamped the roster and obviously a new manager there. Clay Buchholz made some news, or the Toronto Blue Jays announcers made some news about Clay Buchholz allegedly scuffing the ball, messing around with his pitches. Does that really happen that often in baseball? I mean, that seems to me that that is more of a old school kind of mentality. Do pitchers really scuff the ball often in baseball today?
Not really that much today. And I think the tough part for pitchers is that technology is so great. I mean, you got cameras everywhere now, you know, focusing on, you know, everything on the field. So the guy scuffs a ball and or tries to mark it up like, you know, like the Blue Jays are alleging that Buchholz did. It gets caught in camera. So it used to be, you know, even the great pitchers, even Greg Maddux at the end of his career and Nolan Ryan, you'd see, you know, try to scuff the ball on occasion. If you get away with it, so be it. But it's just so hard to get away with it these days.
Yeah, the technology for baseball has been huge in terms of just think about the home run calls, separate from whether or not you can tell someone's cheating. It's really altered the way the game has been. The New York Yankees have been a team that has had a lot of injuries, especially to stars, Teixeira, Alex Rodriguez. A lot of people wrote them off early. They find themselves second in the East, and they've got great pitching from Andy Pettitte. Mariano Rivera has been fantastic. He said on the record he's going to hang it up, but he's pitched so great thus far. Do you think that this is Rivera's last season? And what do you expect from Pettitte going forward for the rest of the season and maybe into next year?
Yeah, I still think it is Rivera's last season, especially with everybody, you know, kind of his good goodbye tour. I think it'd be kind of embarrassing for him to come back. That being said, you can't completely rule it out. I mean, if the Yankees make the playoffs and maybe can get to the World Series and he's still pitching well, he may have a change of thought here. Pettit, you know, Smoltley's playing by ear. You know, I mean, he retired a couple years ago. Surely looked like he was done. I never thought he could do this again, not in the American League. And he's going year by year just to see how he's feeling. But, you know, tell you what, if Pettit keeps this up, you know, he's starting to make a noise for himself as far as being a Hall of Fame candidate.
Do you think Andy Pettit can get in? I mean, I'm happy you brought the Hall of Fame up. There's been a lot of players that have tried to get into the Hall of Fame. They have had steroid allegations that have been difficult. We've seen the Mark McGuire's of the world struggle, the Sammy Sosa's. Pettit's an interesting case because he didn't seem to get as big of a backlash when he admitted that he used steroids to recover for his injury. How does the Hall of Fame deal with steroids going forward?
Well, just so, you know, across the board, just everybody's got different opinions. I vote for the steroid guys. I'm in the minority. But my thing is, these guys are still the best of that era. This happened to be the steroid era. You know, I, you know, some guys, even some of my closest friends, won't vote for a steroid guy that's caught, but yet will vote for a guy who's very obvious steroid guy, but because he wasn't caught, they still vote for him. So, you know, it doesn't seem right with me. You know about Pettit? I mean, Pettit's kind of forgiven. I don't know why. You know, he says he only used it once. You know, that's pretty hard to believe. But just with his numbers, throw away the steroid thing, with his numbers the way he's pitching, he's going to make a case for himself if he's pitching for another year or two.
The steroids are such an interesting dilemma. I mean, there's so much going on there, so many different stories. I've used it once, and then there's A-Rod saying I only used it for a couple years and during this point, and then you have people like McGuire who I don't want to talk about the past, and it came out he used it. People have widely speculated and discussed Barry Bonds obviously using steroids. Who's the best steroid player of them all? Who's the best chance to get in, I should say?
Well, I still think a Barry Bonds gets in, and I think a Roger Clemens gets in. I mean, Barry Bonds is the, you know, go down in history as one of the top two or three best players of all time. You know, if he didn't pitch, you can't say he's better than Babe Ruth. But certainly, he can make his claim with anybody else. And Roger Clemens, you know, and Maddox are the best of that era pitching-wise. So I think those guys eventually get in. I don't think a Sosa gets in now. I don't think a Rafael Palmeiro. But sort of the steroid guys, you know, they're in. You know, and when you look back, you know, who knows? We might already have a few steroid guys in the Hall of Fame, just people don't know it.
If there was a steroid person in the Hall of Fame or a steroid player in the Hall of Fame, do you think that they would be taken out? I mean, that would be unbelievably unusual, right?
Yeah, right. No, you can't take them out. And I'd be shocked if someone's not in already. I you know, there's still a lot of speculation about two or three different guys. But no, you can't take them out. You know, it is a Hall of Fame museum, and you want to see who's the best. And I think it'd be kind of strange for people going there 15, 20 years from now and say, hey, wait a minute, where's the guy that won 350 games? Where's the all-time home run king? I just think you got to put those guys in.
I tend to agree with you. I mean, I'm not an advocate of cheating in any sport, but in a sport like baseball where it seemed to be so rampant, it seemed to be that so many people were using it, it's hard to single out the ones that we just know. It's a tough spot for the commissioner, the Hall of Fame, or anybody to very much be in. Speaking of players that are at the top of their games, Washington pitcher Steven Strasburg has been a sensation since coming back last season. He was shut down because of the innings limit. This season, he has no innings limit. Washington's second in the NL East. A lot of people picked them to do very well this season. They have the two stars, Harper and Strasburg. What do we see from the Nationals going forward?
Well, right now, we'll see what expectations can do to a team and pressure can do to a team. You know, Washington baseball team hasn't had this kind of expectations probably in 7 or 8 years. And it's easy to do it once. It's a lot harder to repeat when there's a target on your back. And they're finding this out. You know, they still have a good chance of anybody to win that division, but there's certainly no lock to win the division, let alone make the playoffs, with Atlanta playing so well. In Philadelphia, still a force.
It's very true. I mean, the NL East is always a tough division. They have the Braves to deal with, Philadelphia, some veteran teams. They also have some doormats, which are, of course, the Miami Marlins after their fire sale. And the Mets have struggled. due to financial issues and their financial situation. A team that has had a lot of expectations put on them has been the Los Angeles Dodgers. I just saw 42 the other day for the slip of the tongue. Their expectations were great. They have not performed up to that level. What is wrong with the Dodgers?
You know, sometimes it's, you know, you got to have some clubhouse chemistry. And right now they're playing like the Lakers. You know, we're just, you underachieve. You can throw all the talent you want in a room, but you better be cohesive. And it doesn't look like they have that right now. They've also been beat up, you know, pretty good on injuries. And, you know, they opened the season with eight starters. They've already had to use eight or nine as it is. Offensively, a bunch of guys are struggling. They've only hit 20 home runs, which I think is second fewest in the league. Only averaging about 3.5 runs a game, which is second lowest. So they got to get that offense going. And they got a very good hitting coach with Mark McGwire. But, you know, unless that offense gets going, they're going to get left in the pack here pretty soon.
I think the perfect example would be Matt Kemp, who has been a fantastic hitter, one of the best hitters in baseball the past couple seasons, only hitting .260. So the Dodgers, they need to get it going here. Getting Hanley Ramirez back, I think, would be huge for them because he adds them another bat. Even though he might hurt them a little bit defensively, he gives them another bat. A team that has been remarkable, they just seem to retool every year, has been the St. Louis Cardinals. And they are led by, of course, Adam Wainwright, who is a great pitcher. What can you tell me about Adam Wainwright? Why has he been so dominant this season?
You know, talking to him just the other day, is he's learned a pitch. When he was in the disabled list over 2011, he just learned how to become a better pitcher. And now that he has his stuff back and he's a lot smarter, he's one of the top, you know, three, four dominant pitchers in the game. He says when he takes the mound each night, he thinks he's the best in the league. And right now, it's hard to argue against that. So just everything does everything well anyway, but he's just so much smarter. He's become a little bit like a Greg Maddux out there with a better arm.
Do you think he is the best pitcher in the league? Justin Verlander in Detroit would make a significant case for that, based upon what he has done. Clayton Kershaw for the Dodgers when he's healthy and ready to go would be. Who do you think the best pitcher in the league is when everyone's healthy?
Yeah, I mean, I still got to go with, you know, Kershaw in the National League, Verlander in the American League. But I put Wainwright, you know, somewhere in the top five, six guys right there in baseball. Obviously, Buckholz and Lester pitched the lights out for the Red Sox. But he's been phenomenal. And I think anybody who dominates the American League has advantage over the counterparts in the National League just because it's a lot tougher league to pitch in.
That's a very good point. They have the DH, for instance. It's another bat. One or two more here with Bob Nightingale from USA Today. Bob, we have seen a new scandal for steroids, the Biogenics South Florida deal. Big name players, Ryan Braun and Alex Rodriguez, Robinson Cano have been named. Is there an update on that situation? Are these guys actual steroid buyers and users, or is it just too convoluted right now to know?
Yeah, very convoluted. And the trouble is the baseball can't get guys to cooperate, and no one's, you know, speaking up and saying, okay, exactly what they have. You know, they did have extensive doping records on Alex Rodriguez and Melky Cabrera, which has already cost Grandel from the San Diego Padres. So we'll see. I think they'll try to suspend A-Rod, and we'll see what happens to Braun. I don't think they have enough evidence on some of these guys like Braun or Gio Gonzalez to bring him down.
Is it fair to say that the Yankees made a colossal mistake signing Alex Rodriguez to that long contract? Is that a contract that the Yankees look at themselves and say, wow, we wish we really didn't do it?
Yeah, and people keep repeating the same mistake. You know, the first contract actually wasn't bad. He was producing when the Texas Rangers signed that 10-year for $252. But then when he got that out close, after 7 years, the Yankees kind of panicked and gave him another 10 years, and that was a mistake. But, you know, you're seeing, let's see, Mark Teixeira coming about that contract. He already says he doesn't think he can. You know, Albert Pujols has 9 years left and kind of hobbling around with that plantar fasciitis and his heel. But it's very rare you see a long-term contract work. I mean, when people talk about best free agent contracts, the three you should always hear about is Bonds with San Francisco, Maddux with Atlanta, and Randy Johnson with Arizona. Rare for guys to live up to these things.
Very difficult, especially when you give contracts to pitchers. There have been some terrible ones. Mike Hampton, Kevin Brown come to mind as contracts that haven't worked out well. CeCe Sabathia broke down a little bit. We'll see how long that lasts for the Yankees. A lot of teams are given long contracts. That just seems very difficult to do if you're a team because there are so many variables in a sport like baseball. Bob, there have been a lot of surprise teams. For instance, Kansas City Royals currently leading the Central. The A's are hanging in there. They're second in the West behind the Rangers. And the Pirates are second in the Central in the NL. Which one of these teams do you think can make a run to the playoffs? Which one of them has the most staying power?
I think keep an eye on Kansas City Royals, Mike. I think they're for real. I think they can win a wild card spot. They're built to win now. They traded for James Shields. The club's, you know, matured. And they, you know, it's almost like they have to win now, because if they don't, if you see some firings taking place in the front office and on the field with Ned Yost as a manager and Dayton Moore GM, I think they're going to hang around. The Pirates, I just don't know if the pitching's good enough. You know, they always start off great and have that fade. We'll see. I can't see them making the playoffs, though. I think it'd be a too tall of a task.
It's very difficult, and it's always nice to see some of the less fortunate in terms of big market or smaller market teams compete in baseball. It's always nice to see a different change. And finally, Bob, Toronto made a ton of news in the offseason. They were a team that a lot of people picked to do well. They bring in Jose Reyes, among others, and they've struggled. Reyes finds himself hurt, and Toronto finds himself last in the East. Can the Blue Jays turn this around, or is this a lost cause for them?
You hate to say it, but it may be a lost cause. I thought the one guy that couldn't afford to lose, injury-wise, was Jose Reyes. They're not without him now for another two and a half months. They're not pitching the same. You know, Mark Burley's just been okay. You know, Bird hasn't pitched nearly as well as the past. So, I don't know. I just think they're almost like too far in the hole already, and you want them to come out of it. I'm not sure they can. Also, I'm not sure they have that same clubhouse fire like another lot of teams, just because those guys are so new and still trying to learn each other.
That's true, and you bring over Josh Johnson, a guy who at times has looked dominant in his career. He finds himself in the DL again. It seems like he's always hurt. R.A. Dickey coming over from the Mets. The knuckleball at times has looked good, at times it hasn't. So it's a very difficult place for the Blue Jays to be in, especially with so many teams in front of them, the Yankees, Red Sox. The Orioles obviously have been a very good team from last year to this year. And the Rays are always dangerous. Joe Maddon, one of the best managers in baseball. It's tough to be a Blue Jay fan in Canada. Bob, where can some of our listeners find you, interact with you, and read some of your columns?
Yeah, just on usatoday.com. And everything is there if you don't want to buy the paper for a buck. And, or the Twitter site is just BNightingale. And a lot of times I write a story or a column, at least refer to it from the Twitter account.
So if you want to get in touch with Bob, you can get him on Twitter, which it seems like that's where everyone's going these days. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's amazing how popular that thing has become.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's a great idea. You can interact with some of your favorite writers, media personalities, the whole nine yards. Bob, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Into Second Down now, I am joined by the head basketball coach at Arizona State University, Herb Sendek. Coach, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm good. A different brand of basketball this season. I would say more up-tempo. And the big news that point guard Jahi Carson is going to stick around. First, what initiated the shift in the style of play, and how big is that for ASU?
Well, certainly Jahi playing the point guard had a great deal to do with our changing our style of play. Our personnel dictated our system. And with Jahi at the point guard, given his ability to really push the ball, his speed from end line to end line, it just made great sense for us to play faster. And in fact, at the end of the day, I think we played as fast as most any team, at least on the West Coast, and we'd like to continue to push it and really be a team that attacks in transition. The second part, Jahi coming back for yet another season is great news for the Sun Devil community, and really I think a credit to he and his family that they really astutely looked at the situation and made a great decision. So I think everybody's a winner in this particular case, and we're excited to move forward into next season.
I would agree with you. I think the ASU community really rallied around Jahid because he's a very talented player. I think he will eventually be an NBA player. He definitely has the talent to. But not many people had extremely high expectations for ASU. The team was very close to making the tournament and had a great NIT run, getting knocked out by a tough Baylor team. How does going to the postseason affect recruiting and, more importantly, gain experience for next season?
Well, I mean, you always want to be a participant in postseason. You work very hard toward that goal, and I think the momentum that our team generated this season is going to carry over into the next year. I think it's also going to continue to have very positive ramifications on our recruiting. So there's a great buzz. There's a lot of excitement in the air around Arizona State basketball, and you know, it's really a credit to the young men that we have on our team. They're a team that is, you know, really easy to cheer for. They're a team that we can all be proud of, not just because of the effort and the heart that they play with on the court, but because of the kind of young men that they are and the way they represent Arizona State at all times.
One of those talented young men, of course, was Carrick Felix this season. As he is moving on, he is a very talented player. He showed his athleticism in the College Slam Dunk Contest. What did you see in terms of growth year to year, and what do you think his professional basketball prospects are?
Well, Carrick had an amazing final season for us. The improvement he showed from the end of last season all the way through our Baylor game was nothing short of amazing. His leadership was as good as we've ever had. His work ethic, his energy was full go. No matter what drill we were doing in practice or what the game situation was, he always gave 100%. And his play was outstanding on both ends of the floor. And I think that all points very positively toward the next level. We're hoping he'll be selected in the NBA draft on June 27th.
How do you replace a guy as versatile as Carrick? Because he could play multiple positions. He was a very good defender, a very good rebounder. And of course, especially in the Baylor game, showed an outside shot that he had been developing throughout his Sun Devil career. What on the court will ASU be able to do to move past his loss?
Well, the reality of it is everybody in college basketball loses somebody almost all the time. Very rarely are you able to carry, let's say, your entire starting five or everybody in your rotation from one year to the next. So I think that's a normal part of college basketball. When you have a guy like Carrick Felix, rarely do you turn around and replace him with one individual. But I think our team has a collection of guys that are going to have to do some of the things that Carrick gave us, and we're going to be a different team. It'll be a new dynamic, and we're going to have to come together all over again.
The Pac-12 has been a conference of much change in terms of coaches. We've seen coaching changes at UCLA. We've seen programs like in Oregon make a unexpected run in terms of how far they went in the NCAA tournament. What is the landscape of the Pac-12? Is it more competitive than ever? And what are some of the things that make this conference uniquely different, or what are some of the unique challenges?
Well, I think our conference is coming off yet another outstanding season. And if you look ahead to next year, I think we'll end up with more NBA draft picks out of our league than any league next season. I think our league in particular is loaded for bear. It should be an extremely well-balanced, an extremely competitive conference next season. You know, there's great venues to play in, and it's just extremely well-coached, and I think all the institutions are just, you know, great places for higher learning as well.
Coach, how do you compare the Pac-12 to the ACC in recruiting challenges and atmosphere?
I think all about the same. You know, I think once you get into the upper stratosphere of college basketball, you know, in any one given year, a certain league may hold bragging rights. But over time, I think the equality among the leagues is very prevalent.
I think we've seen that in the NCAA tournament. There's mid-majors or teams from non-power conferences doing extremely well. It just shows the parity in college basketball. And because of that parity, it makes recruiting very difficult, especially in the state with a team like U of A down the road. How does a team or a program like ASU differentiate itself when there's been a team that has had such a long history down south?
Well, I mean, let's face it, if what you're looking for is a long history or a steep tradition, we're not going to win that battle with the U of A. I mean, have a very distinguished and long basketball tradition. Not to imply that Arizona State hasn't had spectacular teams, phenomenal student athletes, and outstanding coaches, but the U of A, when it comes to tradition, would win that argument. But not everybody is looking for a school that just has tradition. Maybe that's not as high on their totem pole of things that are important, and we have to try to capitalize on that in those kind of circumstances.
This season, we saw a team in Kentucky not make the NCAA tournament a year before winning it. We've seen a lot of these freshman sensations go into college basketball and leave. Do you think that the one-and-done rule is hurting college basketball, or is this increased parity good for the sport?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it's all one or the other. It depends on the circumstance. I think in some instances it makes great sense for a young man after 1 year to go to the NBA. But I think on the whole, it would be great to see a system where somebody could even go directly from high school. But once they are in college, maybe it makes sense for them to stay for more than 1 year. So it's a complicated argument with a lot of human dynamic perspectives and unique situations. So it's really difficult to paint with a broad brush. But with all the transfers that we have in college basketball today, coupled with the large number of early entries to the NBA, teams can change their makeup dramatically from one season to another. And if a team is able to stay together and, you know, they're an older group that's, you know, gone through different things, you know, they could put together a nice season.
Coach, we've seen, especially here, international recruiting or recruiting of players that are not in the United States. The game is expanding globally. Do you see that as a area in which recruiting will become more difficult, trying to attract kids from different parts of the world to come here?
I think just the opposite. Just as our society at large grows more intimate and closer every day with technology and travel, intercollegiate athletics, professional athletics is much the same. We have record numbers of players now competing in the NBA from around the world. We also have greater competition and levels of excellence in basketball around the globe, as is indicated by the fact that I think the Olympic Games continue to get more challenging as compared to where they once were. And so just the opposite, I think, you know, I would expect to see more and more student-athletes, basketball players come from other countries, just like we're seeing a greater influx of regular students, non-athletes, come to the United States to go to both high school and college.
One or two more here with Coach Herb Sendek of the Arizona State Sun Devil basketball team. It has been an exciting year for ASU fans. I myself went to many ASU games because of the brand of basketball. Do you think that the increased tempo has aided to an increased interest from fans? Or can you play a less fast brand of basketball and remain relevant?
Well, I certainly think our fans enjoy our up-tempo style. And obviously getting Jesse really helped us toward that end. But there are teams around the country that do not play up-tempo basketball, like Wisconsin, who sell out every night. So I think, you know, tempo is one thing, but it's certainly not the only thing that can potentially drive attendance.
And finally, you have coached in multiple postseason tournaments, including the NCAA tournament. How do you prepare for the first game of the tournament in terms of dealing with people's emotions or your players' emotions? Is it a difficult atmosphere to perform in, or is that overblown by the media?
Well, I think what we try to do is establish some consistency and have good habits. And then as we approach games like that, you know, we rely on our habits. So every game to us is important. We prepare. We approach them with much the same manner, and hopefully, you know, going through that time and again, we develop good habits that serve us well on the big stage when the lights are the brightest.
Coach Sendek, thanks a lot.
Hey, my pleasure. Look forward to seeing you at Wells Fargo next season.
Into third down now. I'll give you my take on Derrick Rose, the star point guard for the Chicago Bulls. The Bulls take on the Miami Heat starting this week in the NBA playoffs. Rose has been a huge key for the Bulls' success in the past. During the 2011-2012 season, Rose averaged 21.8 points per game, 7.9 assists, 3.4 rebounds. For his career, he's averaging 21 points, 6.8 assists, and 3.8 rebounds. Rose has been key since he's come out of Memphis for the Bulls. He has been the catalyst, the leader of this squad, a squad that has a lot of talent between a center in Joakim Noah, one of the best defensive players, and an emerging offensive player, Luol Deng. Veterans in the backcourt, Kirk Heinrich, the spark plug energizer, Nate Robinson, who has played fantastic in the playoffs this year. He was one of the key reasons why the Bulls were able to beat the Brooklyn Nets last week. Rose tore his ACL a year ago. In a sporting world that we have seen guys come back early, we've seen them recover quickly. Adrian Peterson comes to mind, the running back of the Minnesota Vikings, come back early. We have seen Robert Griffin III, who Dr. James Andrews quoted as being superhuman in his ability to recover from a torn ACL, both ACL injuries, the same injury Derrick Rose has sustained. The doctors have cleared Rose. The medical staff for the Bulls has cleared Derrick Rose. Rose has been practicing, but he has not yet played. And that is distressing. If you're Adidas, for instance, who has signed Rose to a big deal, made him the face of their shoe brand. If you're the Bulls themselves, who have experienced a ton of on-the-court injuries, Joakim Noah fighting plantar fasciitis. We've seen Luol Deng, who had a spinal tap, possibly meningitis. Kirk Heinrich, a strained calf. All of these are difficult, difficult things for the Bulls to overcome. There's only so much they can do with the limited talent they have. They've gotten great production out of Butler, the small forward. They've seen great production from Carlos Boozer, the power forward, obviously out of Duke, a perennial all-star in this league. Nate Robinson has been fantastic, but they need another guy. They need their leader to come back if they have any hope to beat Miami. Frankly, I don't think they will beat the Heat. But Derrick Rose, it has been over a year since you tore your ACL, and you said on the record that you don't feel mentally ready to come back. Derrick Rose is paid to play basketball. His profession is to play sports. He is the leader of the Chicago Bulls. He is the face of the franchise. He is the only player that is capable of lifting this team to a potential upset, even though it is extremely unlikely. Derrick Rose has said, and this is a quote from him regarding his possible return, "It is still up in the air. I might have a chance. Coach Tom Thibodeau ruled him out for game one." This is what Derrick Rose needs to do. Derrick Rose needs to look himself in the mirror, analyze the situation, and say to himself, am I going to play or am I not? He needs to either commit to playing and suiting up in game two, starting for the Bulls, or at least coming in a reserve fashion, a la the way Jameer Nelson did in the finals a couple years ago against the Lakers. Nelson came injured throughout the playoffs, suited up, and gave his team some quality minutes and played well. That was for the Orlando Magic against the Lakers a couple of years back. It is important for Derrick Rose to either play and show up and participate and contribute to his team or not. We cannot be flip-flopping wishy-washy around. Am I going to play? I'm not going to play. We're going to keep the door open. We're not going to keep the door open. Derrick Rose, you are an MVP. You are an all-star in this league. It is time to start acting like one. You're either going to contribute and play, or you're not. Either which way, the mishandling of this situation going back to the regular season has hurt Derrick Rose's brand immensely. Rose was known as one of the toughest players, one of the more gutty players in the league. The way he takes the ball to the hole hard, the way that he has no problem finishing, the way he is fearless in the face of contact. Derrick Rose, it is time to act like the superstar that you are. Either you play or you don't. Either way, let's end the circus. Which brings us to fourth down. And speaking of circus, that is, of course, the New York Jets. The Jets, 2 weeks ago in the NFL draft, drafted Geno Smith in the top of the second round, the quarterback out of West Virginia. He was the second quarterback selected in the draft behind E.J. Manuel. ESPN draft experts Todd McShay and Mel Kiper Jr. both had Geno Smith as the number one quarterback on their boards. There was talk that Smith would go as high to the Eagles as 4, 7 to the Browns, but those prognostications did not happen. They did not pan out. Smith found himself in maybe the worst situation a young quarterback could be in. Under the spotlight of the New York Jets, under the ineptitude of Rex Ryan in terms of coaching an offense, and having to compete with Mark Sanchez, a guy who has an enormous contract. A contract that he nowhere near, not even in the realm of possibility, could perform up to based upon what he has showed us these past two seasons with the 50 turnovers and the inept play and the terrible images of the horrifically overthrown interceptions, running into his offensive lineman and fumbling. That Thanksgiving game against New England will be burned into the minds of Jet fans for life. And that's not even to mention the Tim Tebow situation in which the Jets threw Tim Tebow around, promised him an opportunity to start, told him to put on some weight so they could run the football with him more. He would be more of an asset to the team, at which point they did not even give him the opportunity to play, and he spent a majority of the season as a quote-unquote personal protector, essentially a blocking dummy for anyone trying to block a punt. And this is where Geno Smith finds himself. This is the exact situation Geno Smith did not want to be in. A situation with a lame duck coach. The fans look at him as the savior. The Jets have limited football talent around him in terms of wide receivers and running backs. Their most physically gifted wide receiver, Stephen Hill, was quoted as saying that he didn't know or he had problems understanding the, quote, football concept. End quote. That's Geno Smith's number one receiver. Smith played in Danner Holgorsen's very upbeat, very high, fast, complex offense. If you watched the John Gruden quarterback camp with Geno Smith, if you saw any of the highlights, you saw there was a lot of moving parts. There was receivers in motion, running backs coming out of the backfield, lining up in the slot, out wide, a lot of motion, a lot of shifting. It is a complex offense. Geno Smith goes from a complex offense to what last season was a very simplistic one under Tony Sparano. Sparano has been fired. The Jets retool. But still, the problems of the New York Jets remain. They have an ineffective quarterback in Mark Sanchez, a quarterback that Geno Smith should beat out, but should not have to even be put in that position, as the Jets should have cut bait with Sanchez. But Geno Smith shouldn't even have to beat him out. He shouldn't even have to put in that position. Mark Sanchez's play has been that ineffective. They have not given him any wide receivers. Stephen Hill with the physical ability, we know that. We saw game one last season against Buffalo, the 2 touchdowns. He can, at times, look dominant. Santonio Holmes coming off an injury. They let Dustin Keller, their tight end, go. They don't have any star running backs, and their offensive line struggled. The Brickashaw Ferguson is still a good offensive tackle at left tackle, but he has regressed. Nick Mangold is the best offensive lineman. He's a center. Their guards and right tackle situation is abysmal. The New York Jets have set Geno Smith up to fail. This is not the only quarterback they've set up to fail. The organization as a whole has a reputation. Sanchez was given every opportunity to succeed. Yet players such as Tebow and now Geno Smith are given situations that are just terrible to be in. I don't know if Woody Johnson gets it. He is the owner. He's a very successful businessman. He will probably make more money in his life than I'll make in mine. But he does not seem to grasp the concept of a quarterback, of what a quarterback needs. When the New York Giants selected Eli Manning, they had Kurt Warner start a couple games and brought Manning in. They put weapons around him. Tiki Barber, Amani Toomer, later in his career, Plexico Burress. When the Cincinnati Bengals drafted Carson Palmer, they let him sit the entire season and let John Kitna take lumps. The Jets are probably going to throw Geno Smith in there. And unfortunately for Geno, like Tebow, the results will not be adequate. And that'll be the show for us tonight. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can tweet me at FifthDownMike. You can find the show on iTunes by searching my name, Michael Fiella. You can also Get in touch with the show by emailing us. The email address is fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. Thanks for downloading us.